Welcome, everyone, to our media telebriefing, Healthcare on the Chopping Block for Millions of Families. My name is Lisa Holland, and I am the Senior Communications Manager for Families USA. We're happy you could join us. And this call is about the decision made Wednesday by the U.S. Court of Appeals to send the healthcare repeal lawsuit back to the district court. It's put health care for millions of families in serious jeopardy. It also threatens protections for people with pre-existing conditions and the affordability of health care. So today we're going to hear from Steve Vinnick of Nashville, Tennessee, and Charlotte D'Alfonso of St. Louis, Missouri. They're going to discuss their anxieties about potential impacts from this decision. And Elliot Fishman, Families USA Senior Director of Health Policy, will discuss the policy implications of their concerns. Following that, we'll take a few questions. And so now we're going to hear from Steve. Steve, please share your story with us.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me on this call. Just to share a little bit about my experience and why I'm so concerned about this. So my story is that I've had a pre-existing condition since I was 12 years old. I'm 34 now. And it's a form of arthritis, a very serious form of arthritis called ankylosing spondylitis. What happens is over time, if it's not treated, in addition to just horrible pain and, you know, reduced mobility, your spinal column will fuse over time. So I started having pain when I was 12, and didn't really know what it was for a long time because it's a little bit strange for such a young person to be having pain, but it got worse and worse and worse. It's a degenerative disease that gets worse over time, and I had trouble putting on my shoes in the morning and, you know, walking up and down stairs, and used to play soccer a lot but had to stop playing all kinds of sports, and was just generally kind of, as I got worse, was walking around, limping around like a, you know, 85 or 90-year-old man. And saw lots and lots of doctors, and fortunately, eventually, took about 8 years, but I got a diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis when I was 20 years old. They were able to diagnose it finally because they saw that my spinal column had started to fuse. You can see it on the x-ray. So the good news, though, was that there was a relatively new class of drugs available to actually not just treat the symptoms, but really to stop the disease progression. This was 2005. And there are a class of drugs. They're called biologics. They're also called TNF-alpha inhibitors. But they're all injection or infusion-based. And my rheumatologist said, you know, given the severity of your disease, you know, I had basically just been so sick and emaciated that for a while they thought I had some sort of neuromuscular thing going on. But they said, given the severity of your ankylosing spondylitis, we're going to put you on, you know, what we think is the strongest one. It's called Remicade, and it's delivered via infusion in a outpatient clinic every 8 weeks or so. So I started that treatment, and it was miraculous. I remember literally the next day waking up, and I could tell something was different and that my pain was reduced. Within a couple days, I could walk up and down stairs without any pain. And with physical therapy over the course of two months or so, I put on 30 pounds of muscle, and when I got back to college my junior year, everybody was just amazed at this, like, transformation. I could play sports again. I was just really it gave me my life back. And so that was great. The only bad news was that it's extremely expensive. It varies. I mean, it's varied over the years, but it's always been in the tens of thousands of dollars per year. Nowadays, it's around somewhere between, you know, $40,000 and $60,000, depending on, you know, where you get the infusion and who charges what. Of course, I had health insurance. This was I was a college student in 2005 and thought there was going to be no problem, but we started to receive coverage denials from my insurance company, and it was pretty concerning because talking about lots of money here. And you know, fortunately, I had parents that had the time and the resources, and we appealed the decision, and you know, we went through all the process, the letters back and forth. It took many, many months. We would send them a letter, and they would send us a letter, and just this whole appeals process, which was really, you know, difficult and, you know, kept us up in the air and, you know, produced a lot of anxiety. And eventually, you know, they were still not going to cover my medication, even after going through all this process, you know, the medical necessity from my doctor. So fortunately, I'm very fortunate that my father happens to be an attorney, and eventually, you know, I had this memory of him sitting out with all my EOBs from my insurance company on the table, trying to figure it all out, spread out over, you know, our dining room table, and you know, gone through this whole process, couldn't get a clear answer. They were still denying coverage, so he sent them a letter, you know, on his attorney letterhead, and you know, miraculously, we didn't get any more coverage denials after that, and they covered my medication. So anyway, I was, you know, always very concerned about health coverage, and was relieved when the Affordable Care Act came along in 2010 and finally had really robust protections for people with pre-existing conditions like myself. So it was super important to me personally. It's been a real just, besides just getting my medication covered, not having to worry about, you know, potentially not getting it or getting put on their other medications that, you know, kind of work but like aren't exactly the same that insurance companies sometimes try to put people in my situation on, and just the anxiety of like not knowing, like, is it going to be covered? It's been a huge relief to have those pre-existing condition protections. And, you know, beyond that, I've actually just recently gone to kind of freelance jobs where I'm trying to do some freelance consulting. And so I don't have employer-based health coverage anymore. I actually stayed on my COBRA health insurance because of just the overall anxiety I've had over the years of switching health coverage and how difficult it can be to get it, my Remicade treatment, you know, pre-approved and pre-authorized through that process. So I stayed on COBRA, even, you know, though it was quite expensive, just because I still have a lot of anxiety about that. But actually, it turns out that my COBRA eligibility expired last month. I went on the marketplace here in Tennessee for Obamacare. I got a plan. I was pretty concerned that maybe it wouldn't cover Remicade, or it would cover it at, it wouldn't cover Remicade, it would cover one of these replacements. It doesn't work as well. But it turns out that it does cover Remicade. My doctor that I was seeing is actually in network, and it appears that everything is going to be great, and I'm saving about $400 a month in premiums because I qualified for a tax credit, and the plan is much less expensive than the COBRA plan I had before. So anyway, I'm just, you know, really concerned on lots of levels that all of this, the pre-existing condition protections, the marketplace coverage, you know, is now in jeopardy again, because it's going to just really impact not only my health, and, you know, if I can't get this treatment that will keep my spinal column from fusing together, but also just, you know, my financial stability, my overall anxiety, and, you know, just how difficult it can be to manage this. So it's been really important to me personally, and I just really, really hope that, you know, there's something is done by our lawmakers or, you know, by the courts or something to protect people like myself with pre-existing conditions because, you know, we didn't ask for this. My condition is genetic. Got it from my mom. And, you know, we just don't deserve to, you know, have all these games played with our health. So that's kind of my story, and I'm happy to talk more about it with anyone who's interested because this is something that's just really important to me.
Wonderful. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate you sharing that. Now we're going to hear from Charlotte. And you can unmute your phone by pressing star 7.
Sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Thank you, Charlotte.
Perfect. So my name is Charlotte D'Alfonso. I don't have the pre-existing condition, but my son does, and I'm a small business owner. So our story is about 4 years ago, we decided to start our own company. One of our big concerns at that time was healthcare, just because of the cost of healthcare, and we'd had good insurance beforehand. So we went ahead and got on the marketplace and got the highest level healthcare that we could. And then about 3 months, 6 months later, my son had a ruptured brain aneurysm, which is really rare in children, and that ruptured aneurysm has also led to a stroke. So when that happened, it was scary. Thank goodness we had insurance. He's totally okay now, but because that happened, he's listed as having a pre-existing condition. So my concerns are twofold, both as a business owner and as a mother. If the pre-existing conditions are taken away, what will that mean for my son? He is an athlete. He's a 4.0 student. He is a productive kid, and I assume he will be a productive adult if he's allowed to be. But if the pre-existing conditions part is taken away and he's not allowed to be on your parents' insurance and he gets out of college, will he be allowed to get insurance that he can afford? That's a humongous concern for people with pre-existing conditions. If he can't afford to get insurance, then that is just such a financial stressful thing for the family. And I know that that is a thing for business owners. So if you have a large employer, maybe they can handle your pre-existing condition and have you on their insurance. But if you're a small business owner, then trying to get someone who has pre-existing conditions before the marketplace went into effect is cost prohibitive. So now if I look back at our own life and my son, if this had happened to my son before we started our own company and I knew pre-existing conditions weren't covered, we wouldn't have started our business. We wouldn't have been able to afford to. And so the employees I have now wouldn't be there. My son would not be able to be productive as a member of society. So all of this money that was spent, what was the reason for it? If besides the life of my son, you know, if you don't want him to be a contributing member of society. So the chances of him having another ruptured aneurysm are less than you or me or most of the general population because he's now monitored. It actually isn't that expensive. He gets monitored every 3 to 5 years just to make sure that an aneurysm hasn't regrown in his brain, whereas most people don't get monitored. And the cost comes in if it ruptures. So Michael won't be costing hundreds of thousands of dollars in insurance, and yet he could be denied insurance because this is considered a pre-existing condition. So that's our basic story. I worry as a small business owner. I worry as a mom about what his future is going to be like. And if there's any further questions, then I'm happy to answer them too. Michael is a fabulous kid, and this wasn't a genetic condition. He's not a smoker, which is one of the risk factors for people who have aneurysms. There's no explanation of why this happened to him. We're in several research studies that we do with multiple different countries so that they can help adults who this does happen to. So we feel like we're giving back to society in that way, on top of the insurance payments that we make to continue. So without Marketplace, my company wouldn't be able to have a place for our employees to get insurance because we don't offer insurance. We offer a stipend from the Marketplace. So that would cost people jobs. And my son, without the Marketplace and without the protection of pre-existing conditions, that would affect my son and his career as he got older. And I hear a lot of people saying that they believe in choice and opportunity. Well, that's why we started our company. We wanted to have that freedom and that choice. And if you take away those protections and you take away that option, then that choice is taken away. It goes against everything that Americans believe in and want in all of our lives. And this is something that could happen to anybody. If you're in a car wreck, you could have that be considered a pre-existing condition if you try. So your employment is really, insurance is really tied to your employment, and that's scary for me, and it's scary for the future of my son.
Thank you very much, Charlotte. Both you and Steve have very compelling stories, and again, we appreciate you for sharing. Now we're going to have Elliot sort of react to those stories and the policy implications of the concerns that Steve and Charlotte have shared. Elliot?
Thank you. Lisa, can you hear me okay?
Yes, perfect.
Great. So I wanted to first just pull out some key policy implications from Steve Enix and Charlotte Alfonso's stories to talk about our analysis of the Fifth Circuit's decision in the Texas v. United States case, and then just to talk about what the potential trajectory is going forward. So one element that is particularly striking in the two stories that we just heard is the pervasive impact of the Affordable Care Act on the availability of insurance and just the diverse situations of the kinds of people who would be affected if the insurance provisions of the Affordable Care Act go away. It's particularly striking that Charlotte's son and that Steve both were affected by what became chronic illnesses that would render them uninsurable without the Affordable Care Act when they were young adults. And some of the biggest impacts on coverage of the Affordable Care Act, the age group that benefited the most, was young adults, in part because they often lack access to employer-sponsored insurance and didn't have other options available to them prior to the ACA in many cases. It's quite clear in both Steve's case and in the case of Charlotte's son that they would not be getting appropriate treatment if they didn't have insurance, and they would find it next to impossible, if not impossible, to get insurance without the provisions of the Affordable Care Act. And that's true in multiple ways. First, the Affordable Care Act forbids denials of coverage to people who are poor health risks on the individual market. It also forbids a variety of ways in which insurers prior to the ACA would deny coverage for specific conditions, either by referring to them as pre-existing conditions, through rescissions in their coverage, through offering an incomplete benefit package, and the Affordable Care Act established a minimum set of essential health benefits that all plans need to cover, by offering coverage at a much more expensive level for people based on their health risk. All of these elements were ubiquitous in the non-group market prior to the Affordable Care Act. Any one of them could have rendered health insurance coverage and life-saving treatment out of reach for either for Steve or for Charlotte's son. And there are tens of millions of people in the United States who are similarly situated. It's also striking that both for Steve and for Charlotte and her family, that the availability of reliable health insurance outside of large employers enabled them to hang on a shingle in different ways, right? But there used to be a problem called job lock that inhibited people from starting businesses because they were dependent on their employer coverage because typically of a pre-existing health problem. So it is striking that the implementation of the ACA has taken place simultaneous with a sustained period of job growth and gradually increasing participation in labor markets. I don't think that that's an accident. In terms of what the implications of the decision in the Fifth Circuit are, this decision is such a spiteful and malicious decision that reflects such a deep-seated opposition, essentially on partisan grounds, to the Affordable Care Act, that it is hard to be optimistic about where things are going. So the basics are that the Fifth Circuit, after the district court judge in the Northern District of Texas ruled that the vestigial form of the individual mandate, so the mandate that people buy insurance had a penalty originally in the Affordable Care Act, the Republican Congress got rid of it in the tax cut bill at the beginning of 2018 or the end of 2017. And however, there remained on the books a mandate to buy insurance with no penalty. Everybody in not just the healthcare world, but in the political world refer to that as repeal of the mandate, in that a mandate with no penalty is not much of a mandate. Notably including President Trump himself, who routinely brags and has bragged hundreds of times about repealing the mandate. However, the trial court judge in Texas, the district court judge in the North District of Texas, ruled a year ago that not only was this toothless form of the mandate now unconstitutional because it lacked a penalty, but it was so central, this mandate that everyone has described as repealed, it was so central to the rest of the Affordable Care Act that the entire act had to be struck down if this mandate was removed. Well, the circuit court agreed that the mandate in its toothless vestigial form is unconstitutional and sent the law back to the North District of Texas, to the district court judge, saying to him, we want you to do more specific analysis of which elements of the law are inherently tied up with the individual mandate. So there has been a fair amount of press coverage of Republicans breathing a sigh of relief that the Affordable Care Act is not going to be ruled unconstitutional during the upcoming federal election year. because Republicans recognize that threats to the core insurance protections in the Affordable Care Act and other coverage elements in the Affordable Care Act, including Medicaid expansion, really hurt them politically in the midterms in 2018. It was the dominant issue leading to Democratic gains in the House in 2018. And I understand the emphasis on that political framing, but I think it misses the particular threat that is associated with sending this back to the district court and the decision potentially not going to the Supreme Court until after the election in 2020. There is a distinct possibility that President Trump could be reelected, and that if the Affordable Care Act is in fact substantially ruled unconstitutional at the Supreme Court level, that he will get what has been his stated wish with regard to this Texas case from the moment that he ordered his Department of Justice not to defend the law, which was really an unprecedented decision, and to rather than taking the side of the United States took the side of Texas and Texas versus the United States. From that moment on, the president has said, this law will get thrown out, and then Democrats will have to come back to me, and we can pick up where we left off with repeal and replace in 2017. Again, this has been his explicitly stated intention. So deferring this decision until after the presidential election really tees up sending us back right back to where we were in the legislative fight in 2017, except this time the Affordable Care Act will not be in place in whole or in part. And that will put all of the insurance protections, which I spoke about a few minutes ago, at grave risk, given the deep-seated ideological opposition to them, both in this White House and in significant elements of the Republican caucus in the House and Senate. So that is truly a gravely frightening prospect. And the stories that we heard today from Steve Venick and Charlotte D'Alfonso really bring out how many lives are at stake, many life plans are at stake, and it is simply a truly sickening prospect that this country could be at risk for taking such a huge step backward in an area in which every other advanced country takes for granted that people with significant medical conditions can count on availability of affordable, reliable, comprehensive health insurance coverage. So with that, I am going to hand things back to Lisa Holland and my colleagues at Families USA.
Great. Thank you, Elliot, for joining us and offering those important insights on the problems faced by Steve and Charlotte and consumers across the country relative to healthcare and this decision. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thank you again, Elliot, Charlotte, and Steve. We're just about over time here, so we're going to wrap up. The recording will be available shortly, and I will send that out, and you can follow up on any questions. If you'd like to talk to Elliot, Steve, or Charlotte, you can contact me via email, lholland@familiesusa.org. Thank you again.